Thank you for joining us this Tuesday afternoon. My name is Carl Wagner, and I am an IWP chapter officer of the Alexander Hamilton Society, or AHS. The Hamilton Society is an organization dedicated to preparing young people for careers in foreign policy and government. The Society also exists to discuss and debate foreign policy issues as they affect the United States and advocate for solutions to them through the Hamilton Way of a More Active America in Foreign Affairs. If you're interested in joining our chapter at IWP, please speak to me after the event or email our current chapter president, Aubrey Hodges, at aubrey.hodges@iwp.edu. We want to thank the Institute of World Politics for allowing us to host this event today. Without the event staff's assistance, we would not have had such a well-planned event logistically. So thank you, IWP event staff, for all your help. I'm joined today by Mr. Michael Sobolik, who is a senior fellow in Indo-Pacific Studies at the American Foreign Policy Council, or AFPC. Michael joined AFPC in 2019, and his work covers American and Chinese grand strategy, regional economic and security trends, America's alliance architecture in Asia, and human rights. Michael also serves as editor of AFPC's Indo-Pacific Monitor e-Bulletin, AFPC's review of developments in the region. In his analysis has appeared in The Diplomat, Foreign Policy, The Hill, Jane's Defense Weekly, The National Interest, National Review, Newsweek, Providence, and Real Clear Defense. Prior to joining AFPC, Michael served as a legislative assistant in the United States Senate from 2014 to 2019. While in the Senate, Michael drafted legislation on China, Russia, India, Taiwan, North Korea, and Cambodia, as well as strategic systems and missile defense. Michael is a graduate of Texas A&M University, where he studied political philosophy as an undergraduate. He also earned his Master of International Affairs degree in American Grand Strategy and U.S.-China Relations at the Bush School of Government and Public Service. Please help me in welcoming him for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much for coming. So let's dive into the meat of our discussion.
Yes.
China. Here at IWP, we all know where China stands from our studies and how our professors talk about the PRC. We also know that China has historically always looked to right the humiliations of the past from the West, and this sentiment in our time is manifested within two of the most important foreign policy objectives of China, Taiwan and the South China Sea. The United States intelligence community is beginning to assess that China will invade Taiwan in the coming years, and that the South China Sea has become another spot just off the southern coast of Taiwan where a conflict in China and the United States may occur. Our roundtable discussion today will explore and seek to devise sound policy solutions outside of what is currently being advocated to counter Chinese aggression as it relates to a potential invasion of Taiwan or conflict breaking out in the South China Sea. So I've got a couple questions written down here, but if you guys have anything in particular, please feel free to join in. Cool.
Sounds great.
All right, I'll kick us off. In evaluating the case for conflict with China, we should begin by identifying the indicators suggesting its likelihood, whether it be an invasion of Taiwan or in the South China Sea. In your experience, what does this look like?
Trying to discern when China will move and what it could look like when it moves. I feel like sometimes the most important questions to answer are sometimes the ones that are nearly impossible to answer with any clarity. So maybe we can start with what we do know. You already mentioned the intelligence assessment that the U.S. government has, that by 2027, Xi Jinping has told the People's Liberation Army to be ready to move on Taiwan. Does that mean they're going to go in 2027 or shortly after? Can't say for sure. But the intelligence seems to be pretty strong that by then, Xi Jinping wants that capability and that capacity to be present. With the South China Sea, it's been the definition of a slow bleed, or slow burn rather, a slow burn. Starting in around 2013, the Department of Defense started to look at these maps in the middle of the South China Sea and say, hey, haven't seen that island before, haven't seen this island before, what's happening here? And what started as this land reclamation campaign undertaken by some of the biggest Chinese state-owned enterprises in existence has turned into this archipelago of military outposts around the South China Sea. And we're talking more than just deployments and ship refueling. You're talking about landing strips that are big enough to service a bomber in the middle of the South China Sea on fake islands. And even now, when I say now, the month of April in 2024, when we are speaking, tensions in the South China Sea are getting kind of tricky right now between the Beijing and Manila. And the one particular hot point is the second Thomas Shoal, where it's within the Philippines exclusive economic zone. China seems to think otherwise. And China's getting more aggressive on sea with their ship maneuvers, as they are in the air with how they're intercepting U.S. planes and other planes too. So in terms of what it could look like with Taiwan, it would be one of the most destructive global events that we would have ever gone through in our lifetimes. I mean, think back to the worst memories that our parents and grandparents have in the 20th century, and then try to imagine what it would look like in this highly integrated information age that we live in now. China would suffer incredibly heavy losses as their invasion armada was sailing across the Taiwan Strait. It would be a bloody affair for the People's Liberation Army. Taiwan would be sent back to the Stone Ages in short order, probably before the invasion force even leaves port from China. And then Japan has islands just off of Taiwan. Right. And we obviously have defense bases all over Japan too. So the question is not only for the Japanese, but for us, what's going to happen to our involvement, not just from a defense military deployed perspective, but from our national interests. And no one knows. No one really knows that question yet. And in the South China Sea, I hope we don't get the answer to that question, but things are getting really tricky between China and the Philippines right now.
Sure.
And at stake is, unlike Taiwan, the Philippines is actually a treaty ally with the United States.
Right.
And the United States could easily see itself getting pulled into a conflict like that. And as the conversation goes on, we can dig deeper into ways to maybe mitigate that possibility. Sure. But what I think your question is getting to, and I think this is a great way to start the conversation, is that not just Northeast Asia or East Asia or South Asia, but this whole construct of the Indo-Pacific that we're talking about, particularly from the South China Sea all the way up to the Korean Peninsula, is a bit of a tinderbox.
Right.
And we're at the precipice of some really interesting times in East Asia right now.
It certainly feels like that with, the Chinese Coast Guard being involved in, Philippine shipping operations or getting involved in that.
Yes.
I mean, the Spratlys and the Nine Dash Line is just such a point of contention. And it puts us, for my own part, it seems to put us in a really diplomatically tricky situation to navigate. So I really appreciate you bringing up the Philippines.
Yes.
You kind of touched on questions 2 and 3, so I'll hop down the list here, especially since you did mention some of our alliances, especially with, proximity to Japan and the Korean Peninsula. Could you give us your thoughts on the stability and growth potential of the Quad Alliance, and specifically, does it have any potential to mimic the sort of treaty organization that NATO encompasses in the European continent?
So I'll answer that by going back to this one memory that for some strange reason has stuck with me from one of my economics classes in my undergrad years, a long time ago. And we were learning this basic concept of what GDP is, gross domestic product. And I am a security analyst. I'm decidedly not an economist by any standard. But for some reason, this one comment from this economics professor I took this class with years ago has always stuck with me. She was talking about what economic indicators can and cannot tell you. And she said, don't ask the GDP to tell you something about your economy that it wasn't ever designed to measure. longer, or what it can't tell you.
Yeah.
And I think, oddly enough, going from GDP to talking about alliances, it's helpful to keep in mind that not all alliances or networks are created equal, or that even they were meant to do the same thing. So, and from America's vantage point of being just so decidedly the not only global superpower, but if you go back to the 90s after the Berlin Wall fell, like, we were the world's sole hyperpower. Right. And that kind of goes to your head after a while,
I think,
especially if you're political elites and you're living in the wake of winning the Cold War without firing a shot. And NATO was a huge part of that. You mentioned NATO. And the whole purpose of NATO was collective security to stop the advance of the expansionary USSR. And when we talk about NATO versus the Quad, we're talking about really two different things.
Okay.
Collective security is, in the realm of like foreign policy and nation states, one of the most vulnerable steps any nation state can take with another, because you're basically saying, my security is your security, and your security is my security. That's a big statement for any government to make to another government, let alone for this whole patchwork of like Western Europe into Eastern Europe and the United States and so many other members just beyond that. That's a huge commitment. And obviously Article 5, which is an attack on one, is an attack on all.
Right.
That's not self-executing. Like, that is a political decision. But even so, collective security, it takes a lot to get there. And it takes a massive, universally recognized threat for that to happen. The Quad is not only is it not collective security, it's not even really an alliance.
Right.
It is a partnership among four nations, but four of the most consequential nations strategically in the 21st century.
Definitely.
And when you talk about the Quad, you're talking about the United States, Japan, Australia, and India.
Right.
And could we leverage the Quad for deterrence purposes, either in a South China Sea scenario or with a Taiwan scenario? It's interesting. When I was in the Senate, as you mentioned, I was basically Senator Cruz's China guy for 5 years. And he, for a lot of that time, he was on the Armed Services Committee in the Senate.
Right.
So, like, trying to beef up the Quad was obviously something that the Trump administration, now the Biden administration, have been investing a lot of resources and time in. Congress was trying to help however we could. And something we were always trying to push in the annual defense authorization acts for the Quad specifically was move beyond humanitarian disaster relief operations and get into joint maritime patrols. Beef up the substance of the Quad. And this is like back in 2015. 2016, when like folks on the Hill were having those conversations. The Quad, partially by virtue of COVID and also just by virtue of China being more aggressive, the Quad is stronger and more substantive with its military cooperation than it ever was when I was in the Senate.
Gotcha.
But then the question is, again, if don't ask the GDP to give you something about your economy it can't give you, can we ask the Quad to act in a way that a true alliance network like NATO could? I think that if we have that expectation, at least in the short term, we're going to be disappointed. Not necessarily because of Japan, because when you talk about Taiwan, Japan is literally on the doorstep of China's territorial expansion aggressiveness. India, though, is going to be really tricky when it comes to not just defense cooperation, but actually doing something costly and substantive in the event of wartime. And their calculation for Ukraine, I think, has been really telling, because they have continued to purchase energy resources from Russia, and Prime Minister Modi has been publicly effusive in his praise of Vladimir Putin at key moments. So the Quad, I think, as long as we have the right expectations for what the Quad can and can't do, and if we take the wins with the Quad where we're able to, I think on the margin it will be a huge added bonus for regional security. I don't know that it's going to function in a really cooperative military sense, at least today in 2024. Could change over time for sure, but we do have a strong foundation for which to build on.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you. Do you guys have any questions? Dylan, please.
What would you think about instead of focusing primarily on quad infrastructure building up, trying to get through the allotments, instead of that transitioning, we could try transitioning away from the hub and spoke San Francisco system with South Korea, the Philippines, and trying to make those three, maybe plus Taiwan and Australia, into our main defensive network and try to get like Article 5 treaty with those groups, focusing more on our treaty allies.
Yeah, so this question is really central to how strategists are thinking about deterrence in the 21st century in East Asia. Like, what is the theory of deterrence that's going to work, and who is part of that equation? Like, which of our partners, and how are we going to organize this? How are we going to conceptualize it? Said more briefly, who's actually with us in the fight, like in a potential fight like this, whether it's South China Sea or with Taiwan? And I think the Quad, because of the limitations that it does have, one interesting idea that I'm hearing some folks talk around in terms of security in the region is you have something like AUKUS, which is really substantively stronger than the Quad because you're arming Australia with nuclear-powered submarines. Which not just the capability, but the technology involved in that capability is closely guarded coin of the realm secrets for nation states. So AUKUS, the nations that are bought in right now, currently the UK and Australia, maybe Japan, depending on how things go. Like, there's been a lot of chatter for months and years, basically shortly after AUKUS was stood up of, is this something Japan could come into in one way or another? But your question gets to a reality of the Indo-Pacific when it comes to alliances. The cross-cutting history of the 20th century is still so vibrantly alive today, and it makes these multilateral, deeply substantive efforts complicated. Japan, for instance. When I went to Japan as a congressional staffer in 2018, they sat us down for our first briefing at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tokyo. And the very first briefing we got was this Japanese diplomat standing in front of the room talking to the congressional staff, and he literally said, the reference point you need to have to understand Japan today is Douglas MacArthur after World War II, because your country defanged Japan. Make sure we can never threaten anyone ever again. Very direct, very blunt, but kind Definitely. Of an illustrative way to start a conversation about that. And like, there's a reason it's called the Japanese self-defense forces. Like, a lot of East Asia has very, very entrenched memories of what Imperial Japan was like. And much like one of the purposes of the UN Security Council, like, there's a reason Germany is not on the UN Security Council. As of World War II. There's a reason Japan has been so slow over the course of decades, like half a century, to really come into the place it is now, which is a lot more forward-leaning, not just with its diplomacy, but with its military. South Korea. I was in Korea a couple years ago in 2022 for a delegation, and interestingly, a lot of the public opinion in South Korea, like, they are really concerned, like, is America really going to have our back if Kim Jong-un decides, like, hey, it's go time, or in a more likely scenario, unintended escalation gets out of hand, and then there's, you know, bullets firing across the DMZ. Like, is America really going to be there for us when we need them? Like, public opinion in South Korea is, like, we kind of want American nuclear weapons on our soil. Because they're wondering how reliable we're going to be. If they need our nukes, are we really going to use them to help a treaty ally? That's not the United States. But the memory between Japan and South Korea, like the love lost between those two countries in the wake of World War II and even previously, there are some dark moments in Northeast Asia with Imperial Japan and how they very aggressively colonized Korea and parts of China. So these memories are still so vibrant and still so strong. And as China becomes stronger, as the CCP becomes more domineering, and as Xi Jinping, his calculations become more aggressive, if those trends continue, we might get to a point where it overrides a lot of these inherent tensions and memories among a lot of nation states that also happen to be America's friends and allies. That balance is still being established right now. And I don't know that anything approximating NATO is going to emerge in the Indo-Pacific. I just don't know if it will. I think what it's going to come down to is unequivocal, clear, strong American leadership and a clear articulation of what our interests are, what our red lines are. But in the case of Taiwan, we haven't been very clear with our red lines for a whole host of reasons. And if we want to get into that, we can in a few minutes. But it's very complicated. And I don't know that there's going to be this easy one-size-fits-all alliance structure that's going to be the answer for it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, let's hop into it. Okay. As far as the red lines that, you know, that do surround Taiwan for us. If we haven't been very clear about it, is there a solid case to be made for making those red lines clear? Or, you know, what does that look like?
Yeah. So shameless self-promotion that I promise is going to answer your question. Please. At the same time. On the 15th of this month, April, I have a book coming out called Countering China's Great Game. And it is a blueprint for U.S. policymakers to go on the offensive and get ourselves in a position to win a Cold War with the Chinese Communist Party.
Okay.
And I write the introduction of the book, rewinding to 2016 when I was in Taiwan, and we were in a meeting with the Ministry of Defense, and the awkward conversation of how long can you guys survive in an invasion without America's help came up in the conversation. And again, this is 2016, so 8 years ago. And the answer that our delegation received was 30 days. China is now better equipped. They have more missiles now than they did then. Their Navy is stronger now than it was then. And their cyber capabilities are better now than they were then, as is their Air Force. So if it was 30 days at that time, the window that we have in this scenario is really small. And how we go about making sure that day never comes is one of the most important objectives of American statecraft right now. This question of do we need to clarify our intent towards Taiwan has been, it's been a hot topic over these past few years. You have former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo answering that question in the affirmative, saying really clearly, like, America needs to have a clear articulation of our intent to defend Taiwan. And oddly enough, President Biden seems to agree, because on four separate occasions, he has answered reporters' questions by saying, yeah, America would come to Taiwan's defense, like four times over the span of how many months. One of those times was in Japan at a public press conference standing next to the Japanese prime minister. Like, if you want to talk about sending a signal to China, that is how you send a signal to China about your intent. But after each of those instances, White House staff would then huddle with the journalists and say, hey, nothing about our Taiwan policy has changed. It's still the one China policy as articulated the three communiques, the Taiwan Relations Act, and the six assurances. A clear articulation of our intent to defend Taiwan has never been a part of America's Taiwan policy since like 1972. We used to be a treaty ally with Taiwan. I feel like a lot of Americans don't even know that.
Yeah.
We used to be a legitimate treaty ally with Taiwan a long time ago. But when we switched recognition to the PRC, those days went away. So do we need to do that in order to have strong deterrence? I don't think you need to. The question, do we need to or should we, like, those are two separate things. You measure threats based on two indicators. You have capability and you have intent. how do you stop the PLA from saying, we can do it, and then Xi Jinping saying, okay, go? Part of it is either saying, if you invade, we are going to make it so painful and so costly that you wish you wouldn't have ever tried. Or we put such a strong military force forward that basically says, if you try, you're going to fail. Two different theories of deterrence. You have deterrence by punishment or deterrence by denial. One is focused on threats and credibility. The other focused on capability and the ability to make sure your adversary doesn't actually accomplish what they want to. I am of the conviction that when it comes to Taiwan, the more credible threat to China is we are so ready and so capable of denying your ability and of frustrating your attempt to actually achieve your objectives that you just shouldn't even try. That is a more credible threat than saying, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, but we don't have the force to back it up. And right now we're in a position where, like, If you listen to Indo-PACOM testimony on the Hill recently, we are not in a strong position vis-a-vis PLA right now in the Indo-Pacific. And when it comes to Taiwan, our force structure, and not just that, but our resupply capability, we have a lot of issues that we need to figure out if we're really serious about saying to Xi Jinping, don't do it. Because if we say we're going to do X, Y, and Z, but we don't have the capability to back it up, that's not a credible threat. So I think the political question of do we clarify our commitment to Taiwan is secondary to the more important question of are we actually capable enough and strong enough to enforce our will on the People's Republic of China should we need to. We need to be strong enough before we issue any new threats or any new diplomatic commitments, in my own opinion. There are good faith arguments from people who are saying we need to clarify now because clarity is stabilizing. I can see in a universe where that is true, but if you say something and you can't make good on it with military force, which is the coin of the realm in foreign policy, you risk encouraging Xi Jinping to say, okay, I'm going to call your bluff, because they have their own intelligence of the U.S. military. They know what we can and can't do. I think that that is a difficult question, and we need to do the work of investing in our military capability if we're really serious. And that's kind of the question that we're kind of dancing around and that I get to in my book really directly, which is how serious are we about winning the Cold War? And I don't know what the answer to that question is yet.
Understood. Because that was going to be the next question.
Let's talk.
How serious do you think we are?
And,
I mean, if let's take the affirmative in saying that we do want to be serious about it. I mean, what policy implications or what policy potential do you see? What needs to be implemented in order for us to effectively win and counter in a Cold War with China?
We need to do more than just react to the problems they've created for us. Like, this was simultaneously really exciting and so frustrating. During the 5 years I was in the Senate, I got to be there right when our China policy was beginning to turn and shift, where for like 3.5 decades, engagement defined our relationship to the PRC, economic engagement, right, and diplomatic. The Wall Street controlled the U.S.-China relationship, basically. And it wasn't really until a couple of years before COVID, but certainly during and in large part because of COVID, that we started to re-examine our priors when it came to China. And in the Senate, I remember a lot of the focus first was, oh my gosh, Confucius Institutes have infiltrated a lot of American universities. And right, there are, you know, a whole collection of problems associated with that. Oh no, American businesses in China are unknowingly or unintentionally complicit in human rights abuses because of the technology they're transferring to the Chinese Communist Party. Both of those problem sets got and still get a lot of attention. Like, I am knee deep in the TikTok debate in Washington right now. And if we want to talk about TikTok, we can. But TikTok is squarely in that first bucket of the CCP infiltrating different facets of American civil society, right? It is a big problem, but we are reacting to problems that the CCP has created for the United States. What we need to do if we're serious about winning is create problems for them to react to conduct net assessments, to formulate competitive strategies based on what we assess the weaknesses of the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army to be, and then test drive those assumptions, test drive those strategies, and put them on their heels, force them to react to us. That is what we do if we're serious. And part of that means that we need to let go of this formulation of we can compete with China over here, but we also can try to cooperate with them over here where we can.
Right.
So this has been the thrust of the Biden administration since day one. And I give them great credit on their strengthening of our allies and our partners, particularly with AUKUS and the Quad. The Biden administration has done incredible work diplomatically and militarily on all of those fronts with allies and partners. High marks. When it comes to bilateral relations with China, I give them incredibly low marks because of their framework of climate change, from the president's perspective, is the greatest security threat in the 21st century. And that means that global problems require global solutions. And China, in that rubric, cannot be seen as anything other than a necessary partner, even though they're like one of, if not the biggest polluter in the world.
Right.
So there have been documented instances, and this is in chapter 4 of my book, I have like this 2.5-page long bullet point list of all the competitive actions that the Biden administration held back on implementing with China because of these other priorities. And if I think the most egregious example, which we can get into now, they sent a high-level state delegation to Beijing on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre to lay the advance work for the Secretary of State's trip later on that month. And their statement on Tiananmen Square was the weakest it's ever been in like any State Department has had in years. And I assume we have a working familiarity with Tiananmen Square. For anyone who may be watching this who doesn't, 1989, a huge cohort of Chinese students protesting the death of a more reformist, liberal-inclined leader and the senior leader in the Chinese Communist Party. He died. They had these massive demonstrations and sit-ins, not only in universities, but at Tiananmen Square, which is right next to the Forbidden City, like the cultural and political heartbeat of China in the middle of right. Beijing. And as these demonstrations were growing and growing, then Paramount leader Deng Xiaoping decided we're going to send in the tanks and the troops and mow everyone down and send a message that we may be opening up economically, but we are not opening up politically. And that anniversary really changed a lot of our China policy during that time. And to send a high-level state delegation on that day was symbolically one of the worst things any American administration could have ever done with China.
Absolutely.
So all that to say, I do not think we're serious at all. And it's not that we're not doing some isolated things that are good. Like, I am of the opinion that we need to separate TikTok from its parent company, ByteDance, in China because of the CCP control over TikTok. Like that is the most important issue today with China, 100%. But strategically, in the long game, we cannot be stuck in this terrain of responding and reacting to problems that Beijing has caused. We need to do that to them. That's how we put them on their back heels. That's how we can shift the competition to favorable terrain on areas that we're strong in and that we can.
I mean, you, especially since you touched upon it in your answer, you know, kind of taking advantage of Chinese weaknesses where they do exist.
Yeah.
Can you specify some weaknesses that you observe in particular, or some of the ones that, you know, could shift or that we could shift our focus to?
Yes. So
chapter six of my book is identifying the party's weaknesses inside of China and then going after them. So practically, that will look like at least one of two things. China's biggest foreign policy project is the Belt and Road Initiative, which has been in existence for a long time, over a decade now. And a huge part of the Belt and Road are these land routes that connect China to the rest of the Eurasian landmass. There are six principal land routes of the Belt and Road, and half of them run through Xinjiang, which is China's westernmost territory. It is where an ethno-religious population called the Uyghurs have lived for a very long time, and it is where the Chinese Communist Party is now currently conducting an ongoing genocide and has been doing so for about 7 years, give or take. Half of those Belt and Road land routes run through Xinjiang. And if you read how the party, including Xi Jinping, characterizes Xinjiang's relationship to the Belt and Road, Chinese strategic planners view it as a crucial hub for these land routes to function properly. And all you need to do is look at a map, especially a topographical map of Eurasia, and you see it instantly. Tibet is too mountainous to service cross-border, cross-continental land routes, but there are these corridors in Xinjiang that are essentially China's gateway into the west of Eurasia. And this has been the case since, like, the time of Christ. So, like, there's a reason a lot of the China's dynastic wars were fought over this piece of real estate, and it's also no accident why China is again spilling blood inside of Xinjiang today, because for the Belt and Road to function as they need it to, or they want it to, they need total control over this territory and over the ethno-religious minorities of this territory. If you are a strategic planner somewhere in the White House, somewhere in the Situation Room, or somewhere in the State Department or DOD, the fact that your greatest geopolitical adversary needs to commit genocide for their foreign policy to work, that's kind of a weakness. And I say that like facetiously, but if genocide is what you need to do for your pet geopolitical project to function properly, that is a lever that we could pull, and we could pull it in a few ways. So a lot of, big understatement here, a lot of global trade is denominated in US dollars,
right?
and even if you're not trading on the dollar or in the dollar, you are needing to access international bank accounts that are dollarized in one way or another. I've been publishing on this ever since 2020, and I've been pushing this idea for years now. If you really want to hold China accountable for committing genocide, what you do is sanction all trade flowing through Xinjiang that's denominated in the US dollar. And not just targeting Chinese companies, but targeting entities in Central Asia, the Middle East, and in Europe that are benefiting from this trade. And the premise is simple. You can benefit from trade that is complicit and connected to acts of genocide, or you can use the US dollar. But you can't do both. And we've done a variation of this before. After 9/11, when Congress passed the Patriot Act, there was this realization that just going after terrorist cells with military force wasn't enough. We needed to go after the financing networks behind these terrorist cells, behind these networks. And if you can dry up the financing, you remove their ability to fund attacks or do anything like that. And we have had really strong anti-money laundering provisions on the books for years to empower the Treasury Department to break up terrorist networks by cutting off their access to US banks. So we could either do this through sanctions or through similar authorities by cutting off the access of Chinese entities or other entities that are involved in this trade through Xinjiang, cut off their access to the U.S. banking system. And if you do so, that is a powerful tool. It's one of the most powerful tools we have, non-kinetic tools we have of foreign policy. If you believe that we're in a Cold War and we need to win a Cold War, that level of competitive advantage and leverage is something to be exercised and refined and used. Another example has to do with information inside of China. COVID became a pandemic in the first place because the Chinese Communist Party cared more about stopping the flow of information about the virus than they cared about stopping the virus itself. In those early days, in late 2019, early 2020, that is one of the primary reasons why COVID became a global phenomenon. And Americans died because of it. So what's the takeaway from that? How the CCP handles information inside of its own borders is not just a human rights issue. It is a national security issue for the United States.
Absolutely.
And I had former Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger on my podcast to talk about this very topic a while ago. And I asked Matt, during your time in government, like he was advising former President Trump, high-level cabinet officials like every single day. During your time, did you ever see the United States doing anything of substance to tinker with China's Great Firewall, to make it more costly, more difficult for the CCP to control information within its own borders? And Matt's answer to me was no. Like, there's next to nothing the United States is doing in this domain of information warfare, not just to make it trickier for the party to control information, but also for us to inject the narratives that we want the Chinese people to hear that the CCP doesn't want them to hear. If you talk about a terrain where the party is weakened, it's not just human rights, it's free speech and just political freedom writ large. Like, when you are in great power competition and in a Cold War, there's something really clarifying, not just about external threats, but really clarifying about who we are as Americans. And I think this is part of this paradigm shift that we need to have, not just as policy practitioners, but as a nation, as a country. America, like, the greatest thing we have going for us is our freedom and our legitimate, open, and stable political system. Our economy is great, but it's not the thing that makes America who we are. Our economy is great because America is free. And if you look at the Chinese Communist Party, like, their greatest fear is an open political system where they no longer have a monopoly of violence and power. That is an asymmetry for us to exploit. And like, this is the heartbeat of competitive strategies and winning a Cold War. Where are we strong? Where are they weak? And how do we compete there? How do we force them onto that terrain? That is the direction we've got to go in.
I guess my follow-up to that, unless does anybody have any pressing questions?
Actually, I do.
Yeah.
You mentioned efforts to change the narrative in China. I'm curious, what would that look like when you had the last decade or so where there's been an increase in nationalistic education towards a lot of the young children. Like, many of the people who live in China, they firmly believe that China deserves to rise up, and that anything against it is just, you know, bullying or irrational, or there are other countries that are just young. So how do you change that around when anytime a missile is fired from the U.S., it just looks like more of a U.S. intervention? I mean, even with there are a lot of people that were convinced Hong Kong was in the wrong. This is just a color revolution, you know, from the U.S. meddling. And, you know, the Hong Kong are being ridiculous. They're being silly. Why wouldn't they want to? You know, so that's what I'm just curious about your thoughts on.
Yes. And so this also gets to, like, where the rubber meets the road of how do you craft messages in this domain. So I think one of the worst mistakes America could make would be to belittle China. China, putting aside the Chinese Communist Party for a second, China is one of the most incredible, imposing, and singular nations on the planet. I've been there twice, and it was my first place to go when I left the United States when I was in college. I'd never traveled abroad before, but I went to China, and it defies language to explain how incredible that country is, culturally, civilizationally, geographically, and just the people there, like some of the most incredible people I've ever met. So I think, first off, being incredibly clear, the United States is concerned about the Chinese Communist Party. And if that is true, and we have no beef with the Chinese people, then we are going to need to be really careful with how we approach the information domain of this competition. When you're asking your question, what came to my mind was how South Korea has wrestled with this exact issue with North Korea. So the information space in North Korea is really interesting. If you can smuggle stuff in, which it's hard, but you can, it's dangerous. But if you're able to get information in there, some of the best things that South Koreans, and I think in some cases the United States has probably helped with this, probably. South Korean dramas, TV dramas, where you're not being preachy and you don't even really have a like explicit political agenda. You're just showing them what life is like. Which one could say, is a soap opera really a good indication of what life is like in any country? But the intent of it is to just give them a picture of what freedom looks like, you know? And this is where I think, you're right, the Chinese education across the country is increasingly nationalistic. And America will get nowhere if we try to convince them that, oh, China's actually bad and America is actually good. Like that, don't know if that message is going to resonate. But heck, we don't have to overthink this. Just like 100 miles or so off China's coast is an actual Chinese democracy. And it's interesting because like Chinese people can go visit Taiwan. It's not like there's this DMZ like there is on the Korean Peninsula, right? But if the United States is looking for ways to work with Taiwan, like this is one of the biggest no-brainer ways in the information space. Because it's one thing for young Chinese students to hear from like a middle-aged American white man how great freedom is. It's another thing if you hear it from someone who's from Taiwan. Like you got to meet them where they are as close as you can. And like the messenger really matters on this stuff. I think there are some really creative things that we can do. And the US government just needs to start taking it seriously and actually funding it and being more forward leaning than we have been.
I had a couple follow-ups to your question or to your answer, and I think it does kind of tie into the information space. So let's go ahead and do this guy here. Can you give us some of your thoughts on how China's capability in the cyber realm and in the space realm tie into, you know, the informational exchange, and specifically? This is due to your conversation that you mentioned on your podcast, where there were no attempts to kind of infiltrate the China firewall, where clearly they are actively engaged in trying to point out weaknesses for us from a cyber standpoint. They have also, I mean, Carlos is very, very informed on the growth of China in space. So can you kind of give us some of your thoughts on how that situation can be addressed from the standpoint of if we are to engage with them on, you know, in a cyber realm, what are our options there, and, you know, how could it impact some of these like larger kinetic conflicts that we see as a potential on the horizon?
Sure. The space realm is going to be the primary, well, not primary, it's going to be the most important military domain in terms of technological advances and an order of battle in ways that I think we're just beginning to understand. And I have a colleague at AFPC, my think tank, American Foreign Policy Council, that just wrote a book about U.S.-China space competition, and they're tracking very closely what China's doing here. And if you look at China's plans for a lunar mission compared to what the United States is doing right now, like their ambitions put us to shame. There is this video that our think tank just pulled from some Chinese government website, and we had someone on staff who translated it. And it is this actual graphical representation of how China plans to build and construct lunar colonies for research. And their Mars plan is far and above where we are. And they are going to space with one intent. They want to dominate it, and they want to win the innovation race before anyone else does. And but from a military perspective, they have already been looking at asymmetries for a long time. Their anti-satellite capability is substantive and strong. And you better believe that in a Taiwan scenario, they have the capability not only to blind Taiwan, they've been developing the capability to blind us as well, right, which clearly, like, the escalatory potential there is massive. Absolutely. And which is, it's risky for them. It's obviously risky for us, but space is going to be one of the most important domains when it comes to Taiwan, when it comes to energy. Like, the amount of energy potential in space that has not been harnessed, that could be with the right technology, like, it's paradigm shifting. And the U.S. government is just behind the eight ball on this, but China is really serious and really aggressive with, again, they want to be the first mover. And it fits this pattern. In telecommunications, Huawei nearly cornered the entire market on 5G, like a last-minute push by the West, led by us, thankfully scuttled a lot of that. Biosecurity, which is an emerging issue, especially on Capitol Hill right now, biosecurity in China, they have these state-backed financed firms. They wanted to find the global rules of the road for biotech in the 21st century. Space, exactly the same thing. This is the benefit of having a single-party controlled political system where they can also maneuver the economy. Like, they have a lot of capital to throw at this stuff. And we don't outcompete China by becoming more like China. We can't, nor should we even try. But we're going to need to get our heads in the game.
Great.
I get into that question in my book too, or do they risk overextending? Because their long-term economic outlook is not good. And it is not really clear yet exactly what their provincial and local debt situation is, but safe to say it's bad, really bad. And their demographic outlook is likewise sour. Like, China is on track to start losing population. I forget what the year is, by 2050 or something. I can't remember exactly. But there is that risk for sure, mainly because the Belt and Road, even though it's not like big high dollar infrastructure projects anymore, they're still pushing the project forward with militarizing sites. They're still investing in new 21st century energy technology with the Belt and Road. They're still investing in mining with critical rare earth minerals and all that stuff. They had the ability to not really have to pick and choose and deal with trade-offs for a while because their economy was just gangbusters for so long. And as their economic growth continues to slow and in the future maybe contract, I don't know. It's unclear whether it actually did contract or not during COVID, but they're going to find themselves in a trickier position. But then you get to the question of how do you allocate your resources? And their defense spending is still going up, at least their publicly published defense spending, which they're spending even more than they publicly reveal. But if you're a single party dictatorship, you have the luxury of saying, we have constrained resources, but we're still going to invest this much in what matters to us. You also have to live with those consequences of how is it going to look to a recent college graduate that went through a rigorous education to be a computer scientist and wants to get a job in Shenzhen, like a lot of his older counterparts did. And then those jobs have just dried up. And like the work culture in China is not getting any better. Like the 996, like 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, especially in the really coveted employment sectors in China, like tech and others, like that's a really draining lifestyle to live. And if you don't have an improved economic outlook on the horizon and you see your government militarizing instead and sending that money outside of China instead of investing in development inside of China, like we're seeing this rhetoric even in America right now of like distrust of foreign engagements, like invest at home before you invest abroad. Like we're having our own versions of that too. But I do wonder how big of an issue that's going to be for China. We don't really know yet, but it could very well be.
I think this feels like something that we've kind of been tiptoeing around as far as a question, and this is more for my own curiosity than anything else. But can you give us some of your thoughts or insights as to, and this is kind of a twofold question, with Xi Jinping, insights as to the significance of his rule as the despotic ruler of the CCP, but also there seems to be a lack of any sort of transition options for when he does inevitably, you know, lose power either through dying or, I mean, he's certainly not going to get voted out by the People's Congress. I mean, how much of a liability is that for China as far as their position in the world? And I mean, is that a potential weakness to exploit in the future?
Xi Jinping has really done impressive work of neutralizing your political opposition.
Definitely.
And not neutralizing in the American sense,
right,
in the cold-blooded Leninist political sense of the word, like life
right.
or death.
Exactly.
Xi Jinping is, at least as best as I can tell, and this is where playing predictive games with Chinese Communist Party elite politics, it's risky to do because our insight into the party is so constrained. I am operating under the assumption that he's not going anywhere anytime soon. He seems to be... From the outside looking in, I think it's easy to view him as really stable. I think it's safe to assume, and an American strategist should assume, that the CCP isn't going anywhere. I think that should be our default assumption. I think our default assumption should probably be that Xi Jinping isn't going anywhere. That said, though, there are, or at least there should be, analysts in every meaningful three-letter agency whose job is to ascertain whether that's actually true. And there were, or at least there certainly appeared to be, key moments where Xi Jinping acted in ways that didn't suggest he was as protected as we might think he would. Think about zero COVID and how quickly the party reversed that policy as soon as those protests began to spring up all throughout China.
Yeah.
If Xi Jinping, and granted, I do grant you, we are speculating about things we do not fully know. But I think it's at least worth entertaining the possibility that if Xi Jinping had been more secure politically, what need would there have been to be so accommodating so quickly on a dime? Was he afraid of the Chinese people, or was he afraid of competing power sectors at elite levels inside of the party who are also frustrated about zero COVID policies? And this is, I think, something that is going to be so fundamental for China analysts. The real power threat to Xi Jinping, certainly he has multiple ones, but it's not solely from the Chinese people, it's rival factions within the party. And he has spent a lot of time, treasure, to neutralize that through his, like, when he first took the position of leadership, his anti-corruption campaign, to be sure, was actually partially about corruption, but it was also really about knocking down rivals and rival networks to his authority and his influence. It's going to be difficult to answer that question, honestly, but I think, to assume that the people we have now are the people we're going to be dealing with, but we need to be testing that. Because again, if we're in great power competition, and if the goal is to find competitive leverage, if you assess that the leader of your rival regime is vulnerable or weak in whatever ways, that's important information to know. In terms of what it could look like, in terms of a successor, I think it's, at least in my book, I think it's too early to say. In the event that they go after Taiwan and they fail, that is more than Xi Jinping's rule and more than his life on the line. You have to talk about what does the party do in that scenario? Because it's not just a failure of the helmsman, it's a failure of the party. Like this overwhelming mission to, in, as they would say, reunify Taiwan, which that's maybe a questionable framing, but bring Taiwan under the sovereignty of the PRC. If that doesn't happen and they try and they don't succeed, that's a failure of the entire CCP system.
Right.
And that will, nobody knows what China would look like in that scenario. Again, the goal should be to forestall that day from ever coming. If Xi Jinping dies or leaves power and China never made a move on Taiwan, that's a win for America. That's a win for Taiwan. That's a win for all of our friends and allies, because he has telegraphed it's happening in his lifetime. He wants to be the one who made China great. And China is great by rectifying old wounds and reconstituting what the Middle Kingdom, China, actually is. And they see Taiwan as part of that, but Taiwan also is not the only part of it. Like if Taiwan falls, they won't stop there, which I think is also underappreciated. But Xi Jinping's future, we will see what that looks like.
I have a question going on that.
Yep, please.
Yeah.
I want to know, do you feel that they would still be a threat after the death of Li Keqiang? And like a lot of these, like he's isolating this group. Do you think that they're a threat to his rule? And this is part of actually. The second part of the question is, what would it take politically with like an intra-party threat for him to either push to invade or actually prevent an invasion of Taiwan? Like, is there some type of intra-party element that would make him do it or prevent him from doing it? I know there's a lot there.
Yeah. I think the honest and responsible answer for me to give is I don't know. I'm not sure. The question you're asking is this really age-old question of what are the fundamental causes of war? Are they external in nature, or are they internal, or are they both, and under what circumstances? The single best explanation or expose I've ever read of that is by this Australian guy named Jeffrey Blaney, I think. He wrote this book a number of years ago called The Causes of War. And chapter 8 is about the different variant causes of war and what's the has the highest explanatory power. Could it be an internal factor where Xi Jinping says, I'm at the cusp of losing what I have, and it's time to throw the kitchen sink and everything, and I need to go at Taiwan in this Hail Mary kind of way to save? High risk, high reward. What leads him to that place? If he were to do that, he would need to be 100% confident of his control of the PLA, which he's spent a lot of time locking down. I think if I were to say much more than what I'm saying now, I would really be getting into the realm of speculation. I honestly don't know for sure. I think, though, that that's a, one of the most important questions for us to know. How stable is he? What rival factions are the ones that we need to be the most conscious of? And I think you mentioned one of them. And then also, in the event that he begins to lose or his grasp of power is loosened, what is he going to do and why? I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Which I think underscores, what do American strategists do when we have these important questions and we don't know the answers to fully? And I think, like, when you talk about statecraft, national security, all this stuff, I think the bare minimum that you have to do is to put yourself in a position to be nimble enough to respond in the moment when it comes, but at a strategic level to shape our own ability to be strong and to secure our interests. And if we consistently try to put them on their back heels and move this competition towards favorable terrain for us, it will become easier, I think, to suss out some of the internal mechanisms, because part of competitive strategies is putting your opponent in uncomfortable, awkward positions. And as you do that, they begin to act out in new ways and you learn things about them, just as China is doing to us. They are trying to weaken American democracy through disinformation on social media primarily, and sow narratives about US being hopelessly in partisan gridlock and how we have all these domestic problems at home. So how in the world could we ever do anything for Ukraine or Taiwan or Israel or whatever? And it's also not an accident that Chinese social media domestically is fomenting anti-Semitism, and they're also pushing that on TikTok. There's a reason they're doing this stuff. They're trying to target our the public opinion of the US and our political system. If we put the party in uncomfortable situations, we will begin to see odd behavior as they have to adjust. And we'll learn, I think, some really valuable tidbits about the inner networkings of elite politics over time. But it's going to take true sinologists and true experts to really study this closely. We're not going to learn that stuff, though, if we don't compete to win. And that's the bottom line. If we're serious about this, we can't do this cooperate and compete shtick that we've been doing. We need to commit that this is a dangerous world. And if America is going to stay free and stay strong, we need to win and the CCP needs to lose.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. thank you so much for your time and the very thorough, very fascinating responses to the questions that we asked.
So it was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me here. I enjoyed it a lot.
On behalf of the Hamilton Society and IWP, thank you very, very much for your time.
It's a pleasure. So,
thank you, guys.
Thank you.